Good morning. So last time we covered a simple design for a cache we called a direct map cache. So for this design we divided up our bytes of memory into units we called blocks, and we divided up our data we would store in our cache into units of the same size. And we mapped each block of memory to one block of cache. And since our cache was smaller, we'd have multiple blocks of memory that mapped to the same block of cache. And, well, which one would we store in the cache? Whichever one was last accessed would be stored there. If we accessed something that also mapped to that, we'd put it there and in place of whatever was there before. To do bookkeeping for this, we needed some extra bits of information. So one thing we needed was a valid bit. We needed to track whether something was stored in the block. One reason for this is when we boot up our machine, our cache is empty, and we need to know that our cache is empty, and you know, there's not going to be some other place which tells us that. We also needed to know which of several blocks of memory are stored in a particular block of cache. And the way we figured that out is we stored what we call the tag. And the tag was the part of the memory address that we didn't use to look up the cache block or the location in the block. So it was the part of the memory address needed to disambiguate what was stored there. We also mentioned our scheme for taking memory addresses and looking up where they are in the cache. And in our direct map cache, we use lots of powers of two, so we could just divide up the bits of the address rather than needing to do any sort of potentially expensive math to do a cache lookup. And the three parts we divided up the address into were a tag, an index, and an offset. The offset would always be in our least significant bits of the address because it would be where in a block a particular byte would be. And since the bytes of a block are always next to each other in memory, you know, that's going to be the least significant bits. And the next most significant bits after those are the index. And the index tells us which row in the cache contains that block. And we choose to have this be the next least significant bits because we want it to be the case that if we have, say, an array, that we can store the first block of the array and the second block of the array and the third block of the array all in the cache at the same time. We don't want them to map to the same block and conflict with each other if we're accessing different parts of the array. We want that all to be in the cache, not to sort of one part of the array to take out another part of the array if they're right next to each other in memory, because that would be bad for spatial locality. And our tag is the rest of the address, so the stuff we didn't use to look up where on the block or what row. Then we started introducing an extension to direct map caches. We looked at direct map caches, so they're nice and easy to do lookups, nice and easy to figure out what to do when we had a miss, what we needed to put into the cache. But we had this problem that sometimes it's just going to be the case that two addresses we're interested in have the same index. And it turns out in practice that this can happen sort of by accident. So an example is if you think of like a program that is using some variables on the stack and on the heap and on the stack, sometimes it will be the case that they have the same index bits. And that would be really inconvenient with a direct map cache. And other sort of scenarios like that can come up. So our solution is that we're going to have an extension of the direct map cache design called an associative cache. In particular, we'll have this thing called an N-way set associative cache, which will, rather than having one block per row, we'll have n. For some n, that's at least two. We're going to start out with examples of two. But you know, we can apply this to pretty much any n we want, whatever we have space for, obviously, because this is going to be a physical thing in the hardware. And this is going to avoid what we know as conflict misses, those cases where we have two different things that we're both accessing frequently that happen to have the same index bits. So as long as we don't have more than n of them, n-way set associative cache will avoid misses for them. So before I move on to talk more about associative caches, questions about things we covered last time? So when we finished up last time, we looked at the result of this access pattern, and we mentioned one problem we're going to have to solve later today, which is if I have in this case, just a two-way set associative cache, when I access something that maps to index 0, if both of the blocks in set 0 are filled, I need to decide which one to replace. And that's a decision where there's actually multiple options, so we'll look at several of those options. But now that we've sort of went through this example last time, let's talk sort of about our abstract view of what our set associative cache looks like. So we have our multiple ways, that's our columns. Each way has its own set of valid and tag bits. Why its own? Because each way could have a block stored or not separately from the other. Each way has its own address that block came from. So we need to have separate valid and tag bits for each of the different ways for each row. And our lookup procedures, we're going to take an index, we're going to go to that row of the cache, and we're going to extract the whole row. And we're going to look at the row and in hardware, ideally in parallel. We're probably going to compare our tags for equality and our valid bits. And that's going to determine which of the two columns, or more than two if we had a more than two-way cache, contains our actual data. So in this example, we take our tag of 1,1 and we compare it to 1,1 and 0,1, and only one of these comparisons would be true. And the one that's true would tell us that it's a hit, and also would tell us which of the two blocks to select to send to the processor. Yes? So the question is, tag even used for anything if there's only one set? Yes. So we have to do the same tag comparison with a direct map cache to know if there was a hit. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, why is only the first valid and tag connected to the MUX? You mean which MUX? This one? So the reason for that is that I know if we have a hit and it's not in the first column, it must be in the second one. So I can use that shortcut. Obviously, for three ways, we have to do something more complicated. Okay, other questions? Okay. So this is, yes. The question is, how do we add associativity? So with our direct map cache, we did the same work of comparing our tag and checking our valid bit to see if we had a hit. So here, we're doing that twice and taking the OR of it, and whichever one of those is true is where we're going to get our data from. So essentially, one way you can think of this is that we've kind of like combined two direct map caches together, sort of in parallel, or merging their operation. Yes?
Did you have a memory register rule you required to read 8 bytes?
So the question is, what happens when we need to read 8 bytes? I've been showing reading 1 byte. So yes, I've been missing some details about how do we access the actual amounts we access, which is typically 8 or more bytes. And there are, I guess, two things that go on. So one thing is that typically our cache blocks are going to be larger than the amount we'll read. So in fact, in a modern processor, they're typically like 32 or 64 bytes. So if we're reading 8 bytes, you can typically satisfy that by going to one cache block and just extracting just the set of bytes of it. Now, of course, there's cases where the bytes you want might be in two cache blocks. In that case, we're going to have some machinery that I'm obviously not showing, which churns one read or write into two cache accesses. Yes? So the question is, if we match either of these tags, we choose that data? Yes. And note that only one of the tags will match, because if we find, if we pull in a value into the cache, we aren't going to do that unless it's not there. So there should only be one copy of any tag in each row. Yes? Question, if there's a miss, which one do we replace first? We'll talk about that later. There are multiple good options. Yeah. Question is, how do I know that offset 1 corresponds to B5 instead of B4? Because presumably I'm writing with the lowest address byte first, in which case the lowest B4 would be 0, B5 would be 1. That answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So the data is stored little-endian?
So question is, data is stored little-endian? I'm just listing the data as a sequence of bytes. So obviously, this is a little too abstracted from how the hardware stores data to know the actual physical arrangement the hardware would use. And in fact, I'm missing some details which are maybe more important about the physical arrangement in the hardware, which is that in typical hardware, the valid and tag bits for both columns will be stored together, just because that makes the comparison easier to implement efficiently. Yeah? So the question is, where is the offset actually stored? So this is the address that's being sent to the cache. Does that answer your question? Yeah? So the question is, why is there this OR here? So the logic that the OR is saying is that we have a hit if there's a hit in the first column or the second column.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that being used there?
The question is the OR being used?
Yeah, but whether it's a hit.
The question is whether it's hit or not being used. Yes. So we are going to make sure we ignore this data when hit is false, because we're going to have to go to memory instead. Other questions? Okay. So something I like to remind people about associative lookups is that you have sort of three possibilities. So one possibility is you look in a row and they're both invalid. That's a miss. One possibility is you look in a row, they're both valid, and you check both of their tags and they're both not correct, or if more than both, like one of all, like 15 or whatever, are not matching the tag you're looking for. And the other possibility is that exactly one of the blocks in the row will actually have a tag that matches. These can all happen. And one terminology note, so I say we have these n-way set associative caches, that's e blocks per set, or e ways. There's also another special term, which is called a fully associative cache, and this is just a set associative cache where our number of ways is equal to our number of blocks, which means we have one set, which means we have no index bits. So the way a fully associative cache is going to work is that, you know, we're just going to have our compare our tags to figure out which block to use. We're going to compare all the tags because there's only one set. And our address is going to be divided up into a tag and an offset because the index is 0 bits. Yeah?
So for a fully associative cache, you wouldn't look at the index at all?
Yes, there is no index. Questions here? Okay. And we did reasoning last time with formulas like this. This is the formulas our textbook uses, like to figure out cache parameters. These are all things I think you can figure out by knowing that sort of picture of what the set associated cache looks like. That, you know, our number of sets is 2 to the number of set index bits because we need to number them going from 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1 with an appropriate number of bits, and our number of block bytes, or block size, that is going to be 2 to the number of offset bits because we need to number all the bytes of the block, and so on. So there's one thing on here which we haven't really gone over, which is this notion of cache size. So when you hear someone quoting a cache size, so for example, if you read marketing literature for a processor, it might say, this processor has a 4 megabyte L3 cache. You might say, what do they mean by 4 megabytes? And they are only measuring the size of the data. So there is going to be storage for tags and valid bits and possibly other metadata that is not included in the size. So whenever you see a cache size quoted, it's just the size for the data, even though there are other bits that need to be stored to make the cache work. And that's why this formula our textbook gives is the block size times the number of sets times the number of ways. So it's just the data part. So questions? Okay. So now that we know about set associative caches, we can talk about real caches, because this gets us to sort of the kind of design real caches use. So my desktop has, in my office, has these cache parameters. It has an L1 data cache, which is 32 kilobytes. That's its size, so remember that's the size of the data. It doesn't include any of the tag bits. It has 8 blocks per set, 64 byte blocks. I have an L2 cache, which is 4 blocks per set, 256 kilobytes. And an L3 cache, which is 8 megabytes. And all these kilobytes, megabytes, are powers of 2 sizes. So kilobyte 2 to the 10, megabyte 2 to the 20. Your exercise here is divide that address 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 into tag, index, and offset for each of these caches. A reminder. I have the formulas there, though, as I mentioned last time, you should be able to figure out those formulas from our picture of what a set associated cache looks like, if you need to. Next question. So what's K and M? So K means kill. The K as in kilobytes is 2 to the 10, not 1,000. And the M as in megabytes is 2 to the 20, not 1,000,000. And when you see cache sizes quoted, this is generally always the case because, as we mentioned, for splitting things up into tag index and offset, we need powers of 2 for that to work. Yes. Sorry? The question is, do you have to convert the kilobytes when you're calculating cache size? So if you're thinking about offset bits, those are based on bytes. So you better have everything in bytes for that. Because, and they're based on bytes because if we add one to a memory address, we go to the next byte. So if we added one, adding one to a memory address went to the next, you know, kilobyte, that would be different. But that's not how our memory works. Okay, so who can get me, who can tell me what's the first thing I should do to start solving this problem? It's a good first step. What's something, yeah.
Calculate the number of blocks.
Number of blocks?
Yeah. By dividing the cache size by the blocks.
Okay, so your idea is, okay, so we want to calculate number of blocks by adding cache size by the block size, so divide 32 KB by 64 for L1, which we can do 64 bytes, which is going to be, if we do, that's 2 to the 15 over 2 to the 6, so we have 2 to the 9 blocks. Okay, so what do we do with that? Yeah. Okay, so if we know there are 2 to the 9 blocks, and we know there's 8 blocks per set, so we do divide those together, and we get that we have a total of 2 to the 6 sets, which is going to mean 6 index bits for the L1 cache. Okay, so that's a perfectly fine way to start. So questions about? Yes. Is it okay to find the set size by using the bottom formula? Set number of sets by using, yes. So there may be other ways to find it, yes. And that is, it's the same overall. And it's closer to what I did, but these are both valid ways of doing things. So there's something which I thought was an easier way to start, something we can get kind of very, something where we can get something more quickly. So anything else? Yeah.
On the offset.
Okay, what about the offset?
If you take the 64 byte block,
So 64 is 2 to the 6. 64 bytes is 2 to the 6.
Yeah, and so they do 6 bits.
So that implies 6 offset bits. And that's true for all the caches. So that gets you the offset for everything because it's always the last bits of the address. So questions about this? Yeah. The question is, how did I go from 2 to the 9 blocks to the 6 sets? And I should probably label this 2 to the 9 blocks. I used my 8 blocks per set. 8 is 2 to the 3. So 2 to the 9 divided by 2 to the 3 is 2 to the 6. And my reasoning that I had prepared is that I would start with the block offset. That's usually where I start, also because that lets me start splitting up the address. And you know, you can take log base 2. And then I just said, OK, so we have our formula that the 32 kilobyte total size is the number of ways times the number of blocks per times the block size times the number of blocks per set. We're following the order that I have written. And we can rearrange that to solve for the number of sets. And I just fill in my numbers and do some arithmetic. I get that there are 64 sets. And I take log base 2 of that to get the number of index bits and got the same answer we got otherwise. And we just need to repeat the second part of the process for all the other caches because we had different set total sizes and blocks per set. And when I did that, I got these answers. So that gives us the block offset bits, the set index bits, and for the tag bits, well, they're just everything left over. I didn't actually tell you how big addresses were, so you can't actually know how many tag bits there are, but it doesn't matter because when you're taking our address, you're just going to say, if I have any extra bits, they're the tag. Otherwise, the tag's all zeros. Don't know how many zeros, but it's all zeros. So then to actually apply this, I would write out our number in binary so I can easily select bits of it. And you know, I can take the bottom 6 bits. That's our offset. I can convert that back to not binary if I like. And I can take the other bits. So for the L1, I get my index is 1.5 by taking those bits. And everything left over, which happens to be 3.4, is our tag. And I can repeat this process for L2, taking more bits. And for L3. Questions about how I did this. Okay, so let's get back to our earlier question of, if I have a set associative cache, where do I put a block that I'm storing newly when I have multiple options? And there's multiple solutions for this, but if we're thinking about our locality assumptions, remember temporal locality says that the thing that was accessed recently is going to be accessed again. So a policy based on that we want to apply is that we'd want to replace the thing that was accessed least recently. The most recent thing we want to keep, the least recent thing we don't want to keep. So with a two-way associative cache, a way we can track the information needed for that is we can just keep track of which block is least recently used. And we'd have to update this on every access. So note, when I say every access, this includes reads. So this is reads and writes. Why reads? Because that's sort of what we're trying to, we're assuming that if you read it, you're going to read it again. So, you know, this is not just when we bring something into the cache, this is when we have a hit. We should also update that information. So this means that if we're implementing this policy, that our operations of just reading from the cache are actually going to internally do a write for this bookkeeping information, even if something is already in the cache. Questions? This policy, and I guess you should note that here, so if we apply what's going on here, we have a 1, meaning that this is way 1 versus way 0, and the reason why we have a 1 is because, you know, 0 was just used, so we set this to 1 to indicate that way 1 is the least recently used one now. Questions? This idea? Yeah.
Why is there one on both of them?
So question is, why is there one on both of them? So let's think of our set one here, which is this row. The question is, which of these two ways is least recently used? And the answer is that, well, we put something in here, so we used it, and we never use the second one. So way 1, not way 0, of that is least recently used. Sort of as a trivial case, we never used it, therefore it's least recently used. Other questions? Yeah.
If you have more than two-way associativity, how do you keep track of
So the question is, how does this extend if we have three ways or four ways? So if we have more than two ways, we need to track an order. So if I had three ways, I need to track, like, it's 1, then 2. And I can update that. 1, then 2, then 3. Yeah, I can update that. And it turns out that that gets rather annoying when we talk about our realistic cache sizes. So tracking an order for, say, 16 ways is actually very expensive. And the logic to efficiently update that order in hardware is not trivial. And the typical solution for this is not to do it. So the least recently used policy is sort of what we want to do for temporal locality. But first of all, it requires a bunch of storage. It requires us to store, if there's more than two ways, it requires us to store that order. And, you know, that's going to take at least log base 2 of e factorial bits based on, you know, what the order is. Probably you'll use more, you won't use the most compact encoding so you can, like, efficiently update it. So that, for 16 ways, is actually, it's not trivial. But when we get beyond, like, two or four ways, typically processors are going to use an approximation of least recently used. So for example, an idea for approximation you might have is maybe you store the two most recently used ways and you replace something else at random. That's going to get you most of the advantage of the least recently used policy, because the really bad things are when you replace something that's in active use when you had an option that wasn't. So often we'll use an approximation where we at least avoid replacing something that's very recently used, but we do a lot less bookkeeping. And these approximations, typically you can get your extra bits of information down to something, you know, that's similar to a number of bits equal to the number of ways. So something around 1 or 2 bits per way that you'll store. Now, sometimes processors have decided, and quite often actually, that maybe even approximations of least recently used are too expensive, that they're too complicated to implement. We don't want to be doing an update every time I have to get a hash hit, because even doing that's kind of expensive. So there's some other policies that are in wide use. So one is first in, first out, where basically you just have a counter per set. You first replace way one, zero, then way one, then way two, then way three, and when you run out, you go back to zero. And note that I'm just going in order. I'm not taking into account, when I get back to way zero is still in active use. I'm still going to replace it with a first in, first out policy. But, the advantage of this policy is that it's a lot easier to implement. A lot less bookkeeping, so it might be worth doing. And some processors even said, well, I don't want to even keep a counter. Keeping counters, that's extra few bits for every set. That's a lot of extra space. So a real policy that multiple processors have implemented is random replacement. They'll just choose a way at random. And you might say, isn't that the random policy bad? And it turns out that when you measure the performance, it's fine. It's not as good as the other policies, but it's not that bad. And that might intuitively not make much sense. And sort of the way I would think about it with locality is that, let's say our random choice chooses something that's in active use. What's going to happen is that very soon, we're going to bring in that something, and with high probability, we're going to replace something that's not in as active use, and this will kind of correct itself. So yes, sometimes we'll be unlucky and have a few extra misses, but it's not a huge penalty, because it's kind of self-correcting, because later on, we'll bring that thing back in. As long as we don't repeatedly replace the thing that's in active use, we're probably fine. So questions about this sort of assortment of replacement policies? Yeah? The question is, how do we do the least recently used? So, I have an example. No. So basically, what's going to happen is every time we do an access, we're going to update that LRU bit. So for example, when I bring in 6.4 here, I'm going to bring it into set 1. So this is going to become 6.4. This tag's going to change. And therefore, I'm going to change the LRU to 0 because set 1 is the most recently used now. So set 0 is the least recently used. Then, let's say after this, I have an access to 0.0, which is going to be a hit. In that case, well, now I've used 0, so it's not least recently used anymore. Instead, it's 1. If I access, say, 0.1, which is another hit, I don't make any changes because I look at that bit and I say, oh, 0 shouldn't be least recently used. Yep, it's done. But basically, every time I have an access, whether it's replacing something to bring something in or accessing something that's already there, I'm going to update my least recently used bit to make sure it's not pointing to the thing I just changed. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So, talked a bit about replacement policies, and you've seen here that we have a whole bunch of options in designing caches. We have to choose how big our blocks are, we have to choose how many sets we have versus how many ways, and sort of our overall cache size. And if we're making a processor, we'd like to think about, well, how does this affect program performance? And one thing that processor designers do in the process of this is they try to divide cache misses up into categories so we can think about, if I see a bunch of cache misses, what should I change in my cache design to deal with that? And there's three common categories that we're going to see. That we divide things up into. So there's one category of misses called compulsory or cold misses. So this is where we're taking the first time accessing something. And in that case, we know that, you know, adding more sets or more blocks per set won't help anything. So compulsory misses, you know, are a thing where, you know, they're going to have these misses, and if you measure those, you know, and your reaction is, my program is slow because we have a lot of compulsory misses the first time I'm accessing something, well, don't make your cache bigger. That's not going to help. Don't add more ways. That's not going to help. What should you do? Well, you can make your blocks bigger, so at least when you bring in the same amount of data, you bring it in bigger chunks. Or you can do something where you try to preload the data using some techniques we haven't really gone over. So another type of misses we'll have categorized is conflict misses. So we've seen conflict misses sort of anecdotally here, that the sets aren't flexible enough, that, you know, we had two things that if we could put things in any block in the cache, we could have stored them, but, you know, somehow they happen to have the same index bits, and therefore we had a miss. And one way we could formally define this is that if we take a cache and we turn it into a fully associative cache, so we kept the block size the same but made it fully associative, all the conflict misses would go away in that design, assuming we had a fully associative with an LRU replacement policy. Now, mind you, we're not going to actually implement that cache because that's a very complicated cache to implement in hardware, because an LRU policy on like 1,000 blocks is a lot of bookkeeping. But we can simulate that sort of thing, and we can reason about, you know, are these misses that we could possibly have helped by increasing our number of ways or doing something related to that. And all the other misses are what we'll call capacity misses. So sometimes our program just accesses too much data. If I have a program that's, you know, making multiple passes through a megabyte array, there is no way I'm not going to have a lot of misses with a 32 kilobyte cache. Like, it's just not possible. And that's what we mean by capacity misses. Like, that no matter what strategy we use for deciding what to keep in the cache, we're going to have some misses. And those are capacity misses. So questions about these types of misses. And we'll look later on about how strategy, different design changes affect these.
Are all misses either one of the three types?
So questions, are all misses one of the three types? Yes. So in this categorization, basically, if it's not a compulsory or conflict miss, we're going to call it a capacity miss. So in a real processor, there might be some extra categories of misses that don't fit that have to do with concurrency, but we're only dealing with one core, so we're not going to have those. Other questions? Okay. So this is how you should think about, you know, if I'm designing a cache, how would I change things in the cache? You're going to look at how particular programs have these types of misses or not, probably by doing a simulation. Yes?
Can you draw an example of a fully associative
cache? So question, can I draw what a fully associative cache looks like? So a fully associative cache is going to have, we'll have a valid bit and a tag bit and data, and a valid bit and a tag bit and data, and a valid bit and a tag bit and data, so and so on. And we'll have something which compares our input address to each of the tags. And something which selects using that information from each of the possible blocks, each of the possible blocks. And so this is sort of the brute force, let's make sure we don't have conflict misses cache by just having everything in one set. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes. So, question, a fully associative cache, just have one block for each one? So, in a fully associative cache, yes, there's one set, so each way has only one block. Other questions? Okay. So, we talked a bunch about how reads for caches work, and we need to go into how writing works with caches. And there are two main strategies that caches use to handle writes. So one option is something called write through. So if I make a write, so let's say the processor says, hey, cache, I want to write 10 to address A, B, C, D. So one thing that's always going to happen, no matter what strategy we use, is that if the cache says to write 10 to A, B, C, D, and the cache is storing address A, B, C, D, it better update what it has stored. We'd be very annoyed if I wrote something to memory and I didn't read it back. I write something else back, write an old value back. So we're not going to allow that. So we're definitely going to update the 10 no matter what. But the question is, when do we update RAM? When do we update the next level of cache or main memory? And one option is a write through. And write through, we do it right away. So this is nice in that we don't have to do any fancy bookkeeping. We don't have to worry about when are we going to write it. It's not nice if you think about what we said about latency originally. I told you memory was slow, and now we're making every write actually talk to memory. Now, this is not as bad as it might seem in terms of latency, because we can kind of do this write in the background. So we can tell the processor, yep, I've got your write. We can send it to memory and have the processor move on while we're sending it to memory. But it's still, there's a limit to that, right? The process, the memory can't do writes as quickly as the cache can. So there's another option, which is called write back. So in write back, the processor writes something to the cache, and we'll update the cache, and we'll make a note to ourselves that the thing that was updated is dirty. And dirty means that it's different than what's in memory. And later on, we're going to need to clean this thing, which is dirty. And how are we going to clean it? Well, when we're getting rid of this value from the cache, for example, when we bring in something else that replaces it. So in this example, when we read from an address that has the same set index bits, we're going to write out the dirty value to clean the cache before we read in the new value that's going to replace it. Or maybe as we're doing that at a similar time. So this has the disadvantage that now we're making some reads more expensive. Again, hopefully we can do this write process in the background, but you know, we can only do so much of that. Yes? Sorry? This here? What do I mean by the value in the cache being dirty? So we say a value in the cache is dirty if it is different than the value in memory or the next level of cache. So a dirty value is one which is, which needs to be updated in the next level. The question is, does the cache use the same clock as the CPU? So I'm being vague about the timing of this, but generally, the cache and memory we'll work on a different notion. Well, I guess the cache probably has the same kind of clock cycle as a CPU, but it doesn't necessarily do everything in one clock cycle. So some things may take multiple, and memory usually has a different clock than the CPU. Yeah. This question is: can the write-back strategy be less efficient? So, the write-back strategy can make reads take longer. So that could be less efficient because this could be spending time when it's not so helpful. And note that in the write-through strategy, we can hopefully do the writes sort of in parallel with the CPU doing other things. So yes, it could be the case that they're less efficient. There's also a difference in efficiency in terms of whether we're tracking if things are dirty or not. So if we're tracking if blocks are dirty, we are storing an extra bit of information for every single block in our cache. So that's a loss of efficiency there by just choosing to support a write-back policy. Yes?
When the 10 is written to ABCD in main memory, would then the ABCD in cache be marked as not dirty?
The question is, when the 10 is written to main memory, would the ABCD in cache marked as not dirty? So that would be the case if we were keeping the ABCD in cache. But we are, in this case, writing the 10 to main memory as part of evicting ABCD from the cache and replacing it with something else. Other questions? So the question is, if I have multiple levels of cache, would each of them separately track dirtiness? And that is a possibility. Very commonly, you'll see cache designs where they'll do something like have the L1 be write back, and maybe not all the other levels are write back. So that's something. So you might have like your L1 and L 3 be right back, but your L2 not, or something like that. But you'll see all sorts of combinations of that. But so one option for dealing with that is you can decide that the next level won't be right back if that's a concern, or maybe it's not a concern. Yes, question? No? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so with a write back policy, we have this extra bookkeeping where we're going to have this bit we call a dirty bit that indicates a value is dirty, meaning we need to clean it up before we get rid of it because we have to send it to memory or else we're going to forget about some modification the program made. So we better send it to memory because, again, we don't want to have this property that you write a value to memory, you think, and then you read it back later and it's not there. And if we don't write out things that we're evicting, that could happen, right? It could be the case that you modify something in the cache, you read something else that replaces it, and then you read that thing you thought you modified, and it reads from memory, therefore it doesn't change. Like, that would be really bad. We never want to do that. So we have to make sure that if it's marked as dirty, before we get rid of it, we write it to the next level so it's ensured that it stays around. So this write back versus write through is a big decision that cache designers have to make. And sort of our biggest trade-off here is that we have to have this extra bit of bookkeeping if we want a write back policy. And we also have to make the process of reading more complicated. There's another decision about what we do for writes, which is what happens if we write a value and it's not already in the cache. So there's two options for this, that write a value is not already in the cache. We could allocate a block in the cache for it, or we could not. And the reason why this is an important decision is that usually when we do a write, we're writing less than the cache block. You saw that on my desktop, cache blocks are 64 bytes. There's no instruction that you're going to use which writes 64 bytes at once, most likely. So typically you're writing like 8 or something like that. So if we want to store the thing you're writing in the cache, we have to get the rest of the block to store around it, because we can only store a whole block. So the process of doing a write, if we store the thing you're writing in the cache, is we have to read the whole block and replace the part you're writing. So there's two possible policies we could have in that case. So one is called a write allocate policy, where that's what we're going to do. When you write a block in the cache, we're going to say, well, I believe in temporal locality. You're going to read that block again, read that value again soon, so I should store it in my cache. But to do that, I'm going to have to fetch the rest of the block so I can do that. There's also an option of write no allocate. We can say, if it's not already in the cache, I'm not going to get it. I'm just going to send the part you're writing to memory directly, or the next level of cache, rather than deal with the complication of fetching the rest of the block. That's called a write no allocate policy. So questions about these two options, write allocate versus write no allocate? Yes. And a common point of confusion is that this is a separate decision from write through versus write back. So before we can think about write through versus write back, we have to ask the question of, is this block in our cache at all? So we can combine both of these policies with write through or write back. So write allocate, write through means that when you write a value, I'm always going to send it to the next level of cache, but I'm also going to store it in this cache if it's not already stored, to help you read it again later, or read things around it later. A write no allocate write back is that, you know, when the value is stored in the cache, I'm going to mark it as dirty rather than writing it directly to the next level. But when it's not, I'm not going to bother. I'm just going to write to the next level. I'm not going to store it. So those are both possible combinations. However, it is the case that most commonly you'll see processors using write allocate with write back and write no allocate with write through. But that's not required. Yes?
How exactly do you handle the write and allocate case? Because don't you need to know what's in the rest of the block to replace the part you care about, or are you just like kind of trading it off in the next level?
So question, in the write and allocate case with write back, or what? Just how do you handle the write no allocate case? So in the write no allocate case, you're just going to take the write the processor did and send it to the next level. And it turns out that memories support writing smaller amounts than a whole block. So that's going to be not a problem. Other questions? So let's go through how this would work. So if we have a write allocate write back policy here, let's say we're writing OXFF into address 04. So that's not in our cache right now. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to, you know, figure out what index it goes to. Since index 0, it has tag 00001, so it's not in here. So I need to bring it in because we have a write allocate policy. So you need to bring in the block that contains 04. So to do that, my first step is I need to figure out which way am I going to put it in. How do I do that? Well, I'm going to put it in the least recently used one, which is way 1. Remember, we have our numbering. This is way 1, way 0. So I'm going to find my least recently used block, and that I'm going to have to replace. And in this case, my least recently used block is dirty. So before I can bring in the rest of the block I'm writing, I need to write out this other block to memory. So I'm going to write that out first. So I'm going to make it not dirty by writing the modified values of address 0 and 1 in this case, or 60 and 61 in this case, rather. Then I'm going to read in the new block because I need to have a whole block. The processor was only writing 1 byte, but I need both of the bytes of the block to store it in my cache. I can't store half a block. And I'm also going to update my least recently used information to say that now the least recently used block is 0 because I just used 1. And I'm also, and in the process of bringing the rest of the block in, I'm going to include my modified value, and I'm going to mark it as the block is dirty, because I have a value I changed that's not reflected in memory yet. Yes? Can I explain step 3A? So in this, so after this write, I want the cache to have the value we're writing, the OXFF, and the rest of the block as it was originally in memory. So to do that, I needed to talk to memory to get that rest of the block. Yes?
So it doesn't just like stay there until you, there's a period of time where there's like nothing in the block before you insert that OXFF?
The question is, there's a period of time when there's nothing in the block when I insert OXFF? So I haven't gone through the details of like what would be the intermediate states, but we have to go from having a different part of memory stored, so this is a different address, to having the part of memory we just wrote to stored.
So when did you get the OX5?
So the OX05 I had to get by talking to the next level of cache. That answer your question? Other questions? So this is basically, given everything we're doing, the most complicated cache update that can happen, right? So we're doing a write that involves doing a write of something else to main memory and a read in order to satisfy that. And also updating least recently used information. And with write no allocate, the result for this would be that we wouldn't care. We'd just send it to memory. We'd say, I don't have that stored yet. I'll wait till you read it to store it. Okay, so let's do an exercise here. So here I have this cache, and for each of these accesses, would it require reading a value to memory, or at least the next level, or writing a value to memory, or both? And this cache has one offset bit and one index bit, so we can know that this is, so this is, I'll write these addresses in binary for Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay. Okay, so let's start with our first part of this. So writing one byte to 0x3. Who thinks this would require reading a value from memory? Thinks it require writing a value to memory? Okay, so let's go over this then. So this is in, so I wrote out the address here, 0x33, and our offset bit is the last bit. Our index bit is before that. So this is index 1, offset 1. So it's in set 1. So in set 1, our least recently used way is 1. So we're going to replace this here. So to do that replacement, we need to write back the value there because it's dirty. So before we get rid of what's in that what we're replacing, we have to write it to the next level cache or main memory. So we're going to have a write, you know, of the dirty data. So then what we're going to want to have stored, oh, wait, sorry. I am being silly here. Wow, okay. I forgot to check whether a value is already stored. So in this case, the value we're replacing is here. So we don't need to write that back. We're replacing it with the same blocks. This is what I get for doing this on the fly, not having it prepared. So this is, we don't have any writes to do or reads. So this is neither. So why do we have to do neither? Because we're not going to write it back until we replace it. So all we're going to do is we're going to update this LRU information to say that now set 0 is least recently used. But we aren't going to write to the next level of memory because we aren't going to do that until we replace 3.3 and 3.4. And you don't have to read it because we already read it, which is what I missed initially. Sorry about that. Yes? There's no reason to write to memory because our policy is write back. So we aren't going to write to memory until I have to get rid of something from the cache. And I don't have to do that here. So I'll guess I'll quickly do our next example. So reading from byte from 0x52, this is set 1. In this case, we would replace this in the second. I should do this in another call. Second, we would replace this, so we would have a write for the dirty data and a read to read the actual thing we're trying to read from main memory. Yes?
Has the LRU been updated so you've replaced the other one?
So this is, these are each performed alone. But yes, if we were doing them in sequence, we would have updated the LRU, so the other one would be replaced. Yes. So I think I'm out of time. I'll take quick questions, but I know I'm out of time. Yeah. In which one? 52? This is set one here. Okay? Did that answer your question?